From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When I think of hospitals that were turned into war zones, of mutilated corpses scattered on the streets of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities, of hundreds of thousands of children who died because of sanctions, I'm reminded of Howard Zinn's words, "There is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people."
Today, Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She's been in Iraq for months. Nearly 60 people have died in Kirkuk in the past week, not from continuing violence, but from landmines. We'll go to northern Iraq, where hundreds of international workers are trying to demine the area. And we'll look at the U.S. military's use of dolphins, chickens, sea lions, dogs, and pigeons. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. They're demanding that U.S. troops get out of Iraq. The numbers could surpass 1 million this week as the pilgrimage reaches its climax. According to a front-page report in today's Washington Post, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned they could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent it. A meeting of generals and admirals at the Pentagon on Monday turned into a spontaneous teach-in on Iraq Shiites and the U.S. strategy for containing Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq. One of the main strategic goals of the U.S. since the Iranian Revolution in 1979 has been to contain radical Shiite fundamentalism. In the 80s, the U.S. backed Saddam Hussein as a bulwark against Iran, but now the U.S. has toppled Saddam's government. U.S. officials told the Washington Post that as the administration plotted to overthrow the Iraqi government, too little attention was paid to the dynamics of religion and the politics in the region. This comes as U.S. officials told the New York Times that Iranian-trained agents have crossed into southern Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein and are working in the cities of Najaf, Karbala, and Basra to promote friendly Shiite clerics and advance Iranian interests. Meanwhile, U.S. troops detained and later released a senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Mohammad Taqi Mudaresi, leader of an Iraqi exile group, after he crossed the border from Iran to attend the pilgrimage in Karbala. And in Baghdad, hundreds of Shiites yesterday staged demonstrations outside the Palestine Hotel for the second straight day. They demanded the release of Baghdad's leading Shiite cleric, Sheikh Mohammed al-Fartusi, who they said had been arrested by U.S. forces. One of al-Fartusi's students who organized the protests told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "Saddam was talking about freedom while killing us. The Americans are also talking about freedom, but they're beginning to behave like Saddam." Within hours, it was reported that the cleric had been released from custody, although U.S. officials never confirmed he was initially detained. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports hundreds of flourishing gun fairs have sprung up around Iraq since the fall of Saddam. Under Saddam, Iraqis needed to go through strict background checks by the secret police before they could obtain a gun license. Now anyone who has money can buy a gun. At one market in a Shiite area of Baghdad, an oil company worker told the Wall Street Journal people are buying weapons to kill U.S. soldiers if they don't leave Iraq. In the north, the Independent of London reports Americans are accused of turning a blind eye to killings and even ethnic cleansing. Organizations representing the Turkoman population say the U.S. is failing to protect them from the Kurds, who were victims of oppression under Saddam Hussein. In Kirkuk, the city near the richest oil wells in the country, around a dozen people are reported to have been killed. Dozens of families, mainly Turkoman, but some of them Arab, are said to have been driven from their homes by Kurds. This comes as the New York Times published on its front page a picture of new Iraq ruler General Jay Garner receiving a, quote, rapturous welcome in northern Iraq from the Kurds. The New York Times reports Garner worked the crowds like a gleeful political candidate. Thousands of U.S. soldiers poured into central Mosul in tanks and armed trucks yesterday. The show of force was aimed at ending resistance to U.S. troops, as well as intimidating heavily armed rival factions and taking control of the divided Iraqi city. Marines have had a series of gunfights with locals in the past several days. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said yesterday the U.S. case for an invasion of Iraq was built on false intelligence reports, referring to false documents purporting to show that Iraq had imported tons of uranium. He told the BBC it's disturbing that U.S. and British intelligence agencies did not discover that the documents were falsified and asked who falsified them. Blix also accused U.S. officials of deliberately seeking to discredit his team in the run-up to the war in a bid to win political support for the invasion. In a briefing to the UN Security Council, Blix said that without UN verification, U.S. post-invasion inspections lack credibility. U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the Charlie Rose TV show yesterday that France will suffer consequences for opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Powell said the U.S. has to review its relationship with France, but would not say what the consequences might be. News of his comments comes after the French ambassador to the UN unexpectedly proposed the immediate suspension of UN sanctions against Iraq. But Ambassador Jean-Marc de la Sablière also said that the lifting of sanctions was, quote, linked to the certification of the disarmament of Iraq. He said the Security Council should look for ways to combine the work of UN and U.S. inspectors so that the Iraqi disarmament can be internationally verified. Russia and Germany are also saying that UN inspectors should be allowed to join the U.S. weapons hunt. Paul McCartney has called for a ban on cluster bombs. The former Beatle told the BBC that after the fighting is finished, it's civilians, mainly women and children, who are blown up. The interview will be broadcast on Monday to coincide with the release of a new album featuring Paul McCartney, David Bowie, Cat Stevens, and other artists. Profits will go towards charities aiding children in Iraq. The U.S. weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin announced a jump in first quarter profits and raised its forecast for the coming year. Sales at the company's aeronautics division more than doubled. Lockheed makes the F-16 and F-22 fighter jets used in the invasion of Iraq, and Raytheon revealed a jump in sales at the unit which manufactures the Tomahawk cruise missile. Meanwhile, the New York Post is reporting four U.S. soldiers have been arrested for trying to make a profit on the war. They attempted to take nearly $1 million U.S. dollars from the huge stash found hidden on the grounds of several estates in Baghdad. The four men face court-martials. Talks between the U.S., North Korea, and China began today in Beijing. They are the first negotiations since North Korea announced it was resuming its nuclear program last October. The city of Beijing has closed all its primary and secondary schools for at least 2 weeks. An announcement in this morning's papers told the 1.7 million students to study at home. Hundreds of travelers wearing white masks are thronging Beijing's railway stations, desperate to flee the Chinese capital. The panic comes as the government has finally allowed state media to fully report on the disease, this according to Reuters. On Monday, China's top official in charge of Beijing released a statement taking responsibility for providing late and inaccurate data on the epidemic. The Financial Times called the statement an act of contrition not seen since the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. Liu Qi's statement came a day after the mayor of Beijing and China's health minister were sacked. China acknowledged over 150 more infections yesterday, and Hong Kong authorities announced five more deaths. Meanwhile, China's top genomics institute discovered that the virus is rapidly mutating. Hong Kong has announced a $1.5 billion package to help businesses reeling from the impact. In Singapore, the government threatened to jail people who are violating the quarantine. A team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has arrived in Canada after Canadian healthcare workers in two Toronto hospitals were exposed to the virus despite taking all recommended precautions, including wearing goggles, gowns, and a double set of gloves. About 7,000 people have been quarantined in Canada, where 14 people have already died from the virus. Israel Radio is reporting that British Prime Minister Tony Blair warned Yasser Arafat by phone on Tuesday that the international community would halt its efforts to bring the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to an end if Abu Mazen isn't confirmed as prime minister. Arafat and Abu Mazen have been unable to reach an agreement on the makeup of the new Palestinian cabinet and have not spoken since Sunday. Haaretz reports that Abu Mazen has prepared a letter of resignation but has not yet delivered it to Arafat. Meanwhile, the LA Times reports that neoconservatives led by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich have launched a campaign to undermine the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace and criticize the State Department. Speaking before the American Enterprise Institute, Gingrich urged the president to, quote, take on transforming the State Department as its next urgent mission. Senator Rick Santorum, the Republican of Pennsylvania, is ignoring calls that he apologize and resign from his Senate leadership post for comments he made comparing homosexuality to bigamy, polygamy, incest, and adultery. Santorum's remarks came as he talked about the Supreme Court reviewing the sodomy laws in Texas. He told the Associated Press, quote, if the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual gay sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything. The U.S. government was sued Tuesday for maintaining a secretive no-fly list. The ACLU is joining the suit on behalf of two women who publish War Times, a newspaper critical of the invasion of Iraq. Rebecca Gordon and Jay Adams were stopped at San Francisco's airport last August and held for 20 minutes by police before they were allowed to board. There have been many similar reports of journalists being detained at airports when entering and leaving the country and then being told their names were on a list. A spokesperson for the FBI in San Francisco said the no-fly list came into existence after the September 11th attacks and was an effort to gather information about the hijackers. The suit against the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Transportation Security Administration seeks access to records on no-fly lists and the payment of legal fees. After the U.S. government was sued, administration officials said they'll review the policy.
از بر رفیقان وطن دل بیقراره ای دست و بهاره.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go directly to Amman, where Kathy Kelly is standing by, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She has just come out of Iraq, has been there for how long, Kathy?
Well, I first traveled over in October, Amy. I took a couple of weeks back in the States in late December, but I was in Iraq from January through to a couple of days ago.
So you've been there for around 8 months. We haven't spoken to you since the invasion began, since the phone lines went down, since you didn't have a satellite phone. Can you simply start by describing what it was like during the bombing?
Well, Amy, I suppose what I'm most reminded of are the children that were in the hotel that we shared with several families. And in a way, they were very, very courageous. But if you can imagine a three-year-old and a one-and-a-half-year-old, as the nights wore on and day and night there were huge explosions, they started to grit their teeth. And one little girl, Milad, her only way of coping was to constantly enact in her play an airplane hitting her and she would fall over dead. Or she'd take a flashlight when it was pitch black because we didn't have any electricity and pretend to shoot her mother or shoot me. And this was how she coped. And the floors would shudder, the windows would shake, and we began to realize that there really was no place that was safe. Maybe some of your listeners read about a birthday party that we went outside and held on the riverbank, and it was our way of saying normalcy in defiance of what has to be utterly abnormal, this war. And we never, never, never would have placed the children we knew in greater danger, but there was no place that was safe, so we had barbecue chicken and Pepsis and party favors and held a birthday party under skies that were filled with black clouds because oil fires had been set all around the city to try to create greater density that might have perhaps made it a bit safer from laser-propelled weapons. I suppose the pent-up anxiety and fear then gave way to a concern about looters and thieves that were roaming around through the city immediately after the government fell. And in fact, we had word that they were at the bridge, which was maybe about a 10-minute walk away from where we were. And we, in this off in our hotel, began to think, maybe we're going to be the cause of this hotel being looted, because we were the only Westerners there, Iraq Peace Team members, and people would presume that we had some funding. We were then quite nervous. We didn't want to see the hotel windows smashed. We didn't want to see anybody trying to protect us with guns. And then we heard the huge roar of APCs and tanks and Humvees, and the U.S. military came in to occupy the exact intersection where we stayed. And from that time on, we certainly got a taste of occupation. There was no freedom of movement. And in fact, when I left, we were specifically banned from going over to the place where media people are mainly dwelling in the Palestine Hotel, because we'd issued a press release that I think in a very understated way listed the ongoing suffering and death-dealing consequences that were happening, because this occupation came with no plan, with no means to do the minimal to try to preserve life and human rights in Baghdad. And so that's sort of a thumbnail sketch, I suppose. I could also mention that driving out of the city, when I and Kathy Breen and a few others left, we came to a neighborhood on the outskirts called Abu Ghraib, and we'd heard rumors that the corpses of cattle and human beings were strewn in that area, and that there was, this is rumor, but that there was bulldozing going on to bury these corpses. Well, anyway, the stench was just overwhelming. It wasn't the stench of a farming area that's manure. It was a horrible sick smell. And it was just at that point that the long, long convoy of U.S. military vehicles from the Army, olive-green vehicles with their headlights on like a funeral procession, were coming in to replace the U.S. Marines who'd been the fighting force. And I felt that that was actually a sad and a terrible symbol of what we've seen in this terrible naked aggression that has to be characterized as state terrorism.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly. She has just come out of Iraq. We'll go to break and then come back with her. She is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, twice nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, has spent the majority of the past year in Iraq, has just come out of the country, is speaking to us from Amman. Let's talk about the latest situation in Baghdad right now. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged in Karbala. In Baghdad, the hundreds of Shiites staged demonstrations outside the Palestine Hotel for the second straight day. They demanded the release of a Shiite cleric, though the U.S. didn't admit they held him. He was then released. We also have reports of gun fairs springing up all over. Can you talk about what it is like right now and the attitude of the people in Baghdad since Saddam Hussein is no longer in control?
Well, of course, there's a whole marketplace of identities and attitudes, but I can tell you a little bit of what I've heard. One man said to me that Iraqis are beginning to realize that the U.S. occupation will liberate them from the illusion that the United States ever wanted to save Iraq. There is seething resentment over the U.S. decision to protect the oil fields and the oil ministry and not to protect the hospitals and the National Museum and the libraries and the schools. Great grief over the loss of history, of records, of, in a sense, a dignity and a pride that was something that belonged to all of Iraq. People say the buildings didn't belong to Saddam Hussein. They belong to all of us. So there's bewilderment and despair and a great deal of fear. Many people in their neighborhoods are taking turns posting people outside overnight holding Kashalnikovs to guard houses. And these are people who never wanted to pick up guns before. I know one man who paid 2 million Iraqi dinar, 2,000 American, to avoid going into the army. And now he sits out in front of his house at night, and his house had already been hit by U.S. bombs. I think that It's very telling that maybe a few hundred Iraqi people came to the statue of Saddam Hussein to topple it. Now, we knew that neighborhood quite well, and it didn't seem to us that the people who came from the neighborhood. But at any rate, I think we should compare that figure with the over a million people that went to Karbala to commemorate the deaths of Shiite leaders who died, were murdered some 14 centuries ago. I think that's something we should all take into consideration, that the energy behind the Shia sect of Islam, which represents Iran and close to three-fourths of the Muslims in Iraq, is quite high, and that's likely to move in and fill a power void in a vacuum. You know, one has to hope that there won't be great infighting both between the Shias and then between the Shias and other entities such as the Kurds, and yet a smooth transition to democracy seems like a pretty fanciful idea, particularly as it's coming out of the barrels of Anglo-UK American guns. I think that quite a number of people are wishing they could get out now because they are afraid of what the future will bring. And it's also, to me, a very sad irony that some of the people who might identify as very genuine and authentic voices of deep concern for their society, for their civilization, for the next month, who speak English, need, just because of how else can they bring income into their families, to take jobs not serving the interests of somehow developing governance in Iraq, but serving the interests of journalists who need translators. And you see an influx of Western media, an influx of Western NGOs. And it's hard. It's hard for people who've just wanted to preserve a very simple lifestyle, a very simple faith, a very simple culture, to now see the harbingers of Western influence that they don't particularly want for their children, being able to have free rein running all over their city and taking on the responsibility to describe Iraq and rebuild Iraq. I know one builder who said, "Do you think they would ever hire me to accomplish these tasks?" There's a sense that much of the rebuilding of Iraq will be handed out in contracts to ultimately serve the interests of America and rebuild the American economy.
Kathy, there's a front page story in the Washington Post today. Bush administration officials saying they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned they could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent that.
Well, you know, at the moment, I bless the organization of the mosques, which at a time when it looked like utter chaos could overtake people in Aleppo in a very, very frightening way, the mosques were able to, without electricity and over microphones and through distribution of leaflets, get the word to many, many neighborhoods to settle down, to stop the killing, to stop attacking hospitals, to restore a lot of the looted goods, which actually did start to happen. And that was a good thing. Now, I don't know if the Sunni neighborhoods are really trusting the Shia announcement that we are not Sunni, we are not Shia, we are all together. But in a situation where there was a total void of any kind of plan to restore some kind of order, it seems to me that the mosque networks were very, very important. Now, what does this portend for the future if there is an Islamic theocracy? Will there be acceptance and tolerance of the Christians, of the Sunnis, of the Kurds? These could be very, very grave and dangerous realities developing. And yet, it seems to me that the governance of Iraq should be left to the Iraqis to sort out and figure out. If the United States picks out puppet leaders that they could then spit out when they're through using them, if the United States tends to identify with wealthy people who control commercial interests and powerful elites and who have a disproportionate representation in Iraq's population, then I think it will sow the seeds for more material destruction and great resentment. And who will be left holding the bag in the future? A generation of Iraqi youngsters who've been betrayed and badly failed by every entity since they were born.
Were you in Baghdad when Zubaydi, one of Ahmed Chalabi's men, announced that he had been elected mayor?
Well, yes. I mean, people look at pictures on TV of fellows like him, and they say, who is this person? And, to be a traitor in Iraqi society is a very, very grave crime. And it seems to me that almost anyone who takes on the role of governance now in cooperation with U.S. occupation runs a great risk of being labeled a traitor and not listened to and possibly assassinated.
Kathy Kelly, you are known for spending much of your time in Iraq in hospitals. What about the hospitals now? In fact, when General Jay Garner, the new ruler of Iraq from the United States, came to Baghdad, apparently he first came to a hospital and addressed the doctors.
Well, I think that the doctors, once again, have been very heroic, as they have been all throughout the years when hundreds and thousands of children lost their lives because doctors couldn't save them because of the economic sanctions. It's a very complicated situation in the hospitals because they've relied on protection, and sometimes the protection has been provided by sheikhs and imams and people with guns. I think there's not a high level of trust, even within the hospitals, between some of the senior doctors and some of the younger ones, because a lot of the senior doctors were appointed by the Ba'ath Party. It seems that there's more control coming in, but what's not coming in are adequate anesthetics, medicines that are needed and perhaps are not being adequately tested, like blood serums and diabetes medicine. And there certainly is remaining a kind of a triage setting in, from what I'm told, most of the hospitals. I had visited the Al-Kindi Hospital just before it was badly looted and saw doctors who'd been working round the clock, who'd been seeing hundreds of patients. They were exhausted. They say this is nothing new to them because they've been going through war after war. And I think you have to characterize the economic sanctions as having been an ongoing war. One doctor said to me, you know, if you ever brought me to the United States and if you ever invited me to a dancing party, I could not accept. And I thought that was a telling remark in terms of the sadness that's been inflicted on those who tried to cure people and would have wanted to cure their country.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, who's just come out of Iraq, out of Baghdad. She has spent a majority of the past year in Iraq and was there through the bombing. We're also joined on the telephone from northern Iraq by Sean Sutton of the Mines Advisory Group. Mines and unexploded munitions have killed 52 people and injured 63 in the Iraqi city of Kirkuk over the past, well, just the last week. The Daily Mirror of London is reporting most of the victims are children. Iraq is being reminded once again that long after the combat fighting ends, the killing continues. Over the past week, the mine clearing charity, Mines Advisory Group, has removed 30 truckloads of explosives. That is 11,000 mines plus 200,000 bombs and missiles. But it's estimated that 10 million mines remain lying in Iraq over the past war-torn decade. Sean Sutton, can you tell us where you are?
I'm presently just on the outskirts of Kirkuk.
Describe the geography in terms of landmines.
Well, there is a widespread problem. We've still yet to find out exactly what areas are contaminated. But we can pretty much gather that wherever there's former military positions, there will be protective minefield belts. And so that's just about all the cities in the sort of the northern area where we're working, that sort of Kifri, Kirkuk, Mosul areas. There is a vast landmine problem. That's unquestionable.
During the bombing, we were doing a number of pieces on, for example, Hilla, where cluster bombs, where the U.S. military had dropped cluster bombs. When those cluster bombs go unexploded, are they, in a sense, landmines also?
Well, they're actually quite different in the sense that landmines are designed to be victim-activated. Cluster bombs, like other unexploded ordnance, are a problem because of their failure to detonate as planned. But they are particularly sensitive, which is why there's sort of such a stigma attached to the weapon. And they have been used widely, especially around Mosul. And our teams are, as we speak, clearing cluster bombs of a variety of kinds.
Can you describe what a landmine looks like, what a cluster bomb looks like? How can people right now know where they're walking and where they are?
The cluster bombs are one of the most common ones. is a bright yellow cylindrical container, sort of canister about the size of a sort of packet of biscuits, with a small parachute attached. And the problem with those with their bright colours is that they can often be quite attractive to children. You also get smaller, sort of bright, sort of silver-colored ones and sort of larger disc-shaped cluster bombs. Landmines, there's quite a variety. There's sort of bounding fragmentation mines, which are sort of quite larger with a sort of spiked top. And then there's sort of different pressure mines for anti-personnel and the larger ones for anti-tank. But obviously these you don't usually see. They're sort of lie under the ground. But we've got teams going out all over the place that are sort of making people aware of the dangers and certain indications that would suggest that the area might be mined, such as near a military position, dead animals. There's also mine marking signs, which we put up, and also local signs like piles of rocks, painted areas on the edge of the roads, that sort of thing. So it's really critical that the message gets out that some areas are potentially dangerous and people should take necessary precautions. But one of the biggest problems here is the vast amounts of unexploded ordnance that is in stockpiles in all the cities, as certainly all the ones where we're working in the north here. When the Iraqi government troops pulled back from areas, they brought back lots and lots of ordnance and prepared military positions around the outskirts as well as inside the towns and cities. Then when the war was over, the troops left and then left behind these vast amounts of unexploded bombs. And I've been sort of spent the last 15 years in conflict and former conflict zones, and I've never seen anything like this. In the last week, we've cleared in Kirkuk alone nearly 500,000 items. And the thing is, children are picking these things up and prizing open certain parts of them, particularly the boosters, and getting gunpowder and cordite and making sort of big flashes for fun and genies. And that's partly why the accident rate here is so high. As you mentioned at the beginning, in Kirkuk alone, in over a five-day period, there were 52 deaths and 63 injuries, and those are largely from children. So, and considering in Kirkuk, about 15 people were killed in the war, it explains that sort of surviving the peace can be a lot more difficult and painful than actually surviving the war.
Sean Sutton is speaking to us from northern Iraq near Kirkuk. He's with the Mines Advisory Group, which is based in Britain. How does what you're seeing in northern Iraq right now, both the landmines and the cluster bombs, the concentration of them, compare to places around the world?
It's very extreme, certainly with the unexploded ordnance scenario. But that is, with the right resources, that's relatively easy to deal with the trained teams. It's a matter of taking all the bombs away and blowing them up. At least you can see them, and through working with the community, find out where they are. But they are literally stockpiled in schools, in sort of open areas in the center of towns, in sort of government buildings, all over the place. Then the next problem is the landmines, which is going to be a much more long-term problem as far as dealing with it and providing the solutions. And really, we have to prioritize the work. We can't clear all the landmines, but we can certainly clear the areas that are most needed by communities as they sort of come back and start to farm their land. But the big deal, as far as this is concerned, is resources being made available to do this crucial work. And at present, they simply aren't.
What companies make landmines? What companies make cluster bombs? What companies make landmines and cluster bombs?
Well, the cluster bombs that are here are dropped by the ones in the north here that I've come across are all U.S. cluster bombs. In the southern areas, I think British forces have also dropped cluster bombs. They're comparatively, compared to landmines, they're much easier to deal with the right training, because you can see them and find them on the surface, and you basically blow them up where you find them. The landmines are made in former Soviet Union countries, China, all over the world, in fact. There's also ones from other former Eastern Bloc countries.
Paul McCartney has called for a ban on cluster bombs. He is releasing a new album with David Bowie, Cat Stevens, and other artists. All the profits will go to aiding charities that help children in Iraq. How significant is that when a celebrity of the stature of McCartney does this?
I think it's significant. I think that the focus should very much be on getting rid of these things and clearing them up. I think that certainly MAG's position on the legal issue of the use of cluster bombs is very much along the lines with the International Red Cross, which is that there should be a moratorium on the use of them, that they should only be used in for particular military targets away from habited areas. It's very difficult to actually ban cluster bombs because they're a very effective weapon, unfortunately. But the problem is that they do fail, that all weapons fail, and all weapons are a problem after war.
Who is stopping the ban of the bombs or moratorium on the bombs?
Well, no one is stopping that. That's actually happened and is going through as far as international law is concerned. I think that forces have tried to sort of minimize their use, those early days for organizations like us as far as finding out how much they've been used. So far, I have seen one village that was hit that was a frontline position, and the people returned home to find cluster bombs littering their gardens and their houses partly destroyed. But it had been a military position. Most of the other areas, in fact, all the other areas are in quite remote parts where there's military positions. I wouldn't advocate their use, but I think that legally it would be a very difficult thing to do to ban cluster bombs, as opposed to landmines, which are fundamentally different in that landmines are designed to be activated by their victim. Cluster bombs are not designed to do that. So I would also, if you're going to ban cluster bombs, I'd also ban all the other weapons that are causing all the problems here. Most of the problems here are being caused by unexploded rockets, grenades, mortars, and tank shells. Cluster bombs are certainly a problem, but they're a small part of the overall problem.
We are talking to Sean Sutton of the Mines Advisory Group. He's in northern Iraq. Kathy Kelly on the line with us. She's just come out of Iraq, and she's in Amman, Jordan. Kathy, as you listen to Sean's description, do you have final thoughts as you come out of Iraq now after 7-8 months there?
Well, again, I want to stress that a generation of Iraqi children has been betrayed and failed by very powerful elites all around the world. And I know that the peace movement, the anti-war movement, came close to approaching the critical mass that so many of us have dreamed of, have envisioned as a way to stop and deter the build-up, the use, the storage of weapons. And so I hope that Sean's vision that the not only the cluster bombs, but the rockets, the mortars, the tanks, all of the ways that people think change can be accomplished through resorting to force rather than resorting to diplomacy and negotiation and peacemaking. I hope that that dream and that vision won't also be a casualty of this war. It's my hope that the anti-war movement will regroup and recommit. And, you know, David Dellinger once said, quoting a friend, that if what you propose will take 1,000 years to accomplish, that's all the more reason to begin this afternoon.
Kathy, you have spent much of the last, years since the Gulf War, decade, going back and forth to Iraq, challenging the UN, U.S. sanctions. You stayed there through the bombing. What are your plans now?
Well, we certainly won't walk away from an effort to continue to be voices on behalf of Iraqi people. Ramzi Kaisia and Cynthia Banas are in Iraq right now to be joined by 3 team members who will come in through Amman tonight. And yet I think in the United States, we in the Voices Network want very, very much to commit ourselves also within the United States to confronting the war machine and to finding ways to do that that have to do with our everyday lifestyles. You know, as long as we think that our overconsumptive and wasteful lifestyles should be protected by a murderous means of war making, then I think we won't be able to approach establishing the conditions that would allow for justice and peace. So we have a lot of thinking to do, a lot of education and outreach. Certainly we need to continue to develop a focus always in parallel with concerns of average and ordinary Iraqis. But we're looking to that anti-war movement to remain galvanized.
And to those who say, but Saddam Hussein has been toppled, a man who has killed thousands of his own people, your response?
Yes, he was toppled, but we cannot let history become eclipsed. He was put in place through powerful forces that included U.S. interests. He was maintained through the arduous years of oppression and ruthless mob kind of activity. He was maintained, I believe, because the United States wanted him just where he was, crippled externally and strengthened internally. And I think that we have to hold up the mirror and look at ourselves in that mirror as being people who had no problem accepting the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children. Any time that we feel dismay and a sense of bewilderment because of the looting and the thieving and the outbreak of mindless destruction that occurred immediately following the U.S. occupation and the crumbling of the regime of Saddam Hussein. I think that that same kind of mindless destruction goes on every day in our society. When you look at the way we treat our planet environmentally, we don't think twice about bringing the planet into ruination. And I think that the same utter lack of concern for innocent human lives characterized U.S. policy all throughout the miserable decade since Saddam Hussein came into power.
Kathy Kelly, thank you very much for being with us, speaking from Amman, just out of Iraq. Look forward to seeing you when you come back to the United States. She is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the use of animals by the military. Stay with us.
باز آمدم باز آمدم از پیش یار آمدم در من نگر در من نگر بحر تو غم خار آمدم شاد آمدم شاد آمدم از جند آزاد آمدم چندین هزاران سال شد تا من به گفتار آمدم تا من به گفتار آمدم
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. War is not healthy for children and other living things. These words were first written by mothers in the United States during the Vietnam War. They were concerned their children were being sent halfway around the world to kill the children of Vietnamese mothers. They put the statement on a postcard and they sent it to Congress. Since then, the words have become a powerful description of wartime destruction of not only people, but also of animals and the environment. In the invasion of Iraq, the Pentagon reportedly has enlisted dolphins, chickens, dogs, sea lions, and pigeons. Plus, there are reports that Morocco gave the U.S. 2,000 monkeys to assist with demining projects. Dolphins are scouting seaports in search of mines. The dolphins are equipped with cameras that transmit video images back to their handlers. When they find a mine, they're trained to report back by playing with a so-called "I've found something" rubber ball. When the dolphins find a mine, their minder sends a group of human divers to the area to detonate it. The Washington Post reports that Atlantic bottlenose dolphin is the seafaring equivalent of bomb-sniffing dogs. The Marines have been using chickens and pigeons in Kuwait to detect poison gas, but the Marines have admitted that dozens of the birds never made it to the Middle East after dying in transit. The deceased chickens and pigeons will hardly be the first U.S. animals not to return to the States after a war. According to PETA, 5,000 dogs served alongside U.S. troops in Vietnam. Only 140 came home. Some died in Vietnam, but most were abandoned by the military. We're joined right now by William Rivas Rivas of PETA and David Helvarg. He's the author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. We tried to get someone on from the Navy, but they said they were not available. William Rivas Rivas, can you describe the extent of the use of animals and your concerns?
Good morning, Amy. We are appalled to hear that the military has essentially drafted these animals that claim no nation, know nothing of Saddam Hussein or Iraq, and sent them to a war that they do not understand. They are using dolphins, as you mentioned, sea lions, pigeons, and chickens to detect chemical weapons and search for mines. We believe that this is completely unethical, that the military should be using technology, the technology that's available, instead of using animals to detect these chemical weapons or search for mines.
David Helvarg, you have looked extensively into this issue. Can you give us a history of the use of dolphins?
Sure, Amy. The program actually goes back to 1960, so the Navy's had marine mammals for 43 years now, not only dolphins and sea lions, but they still have beluga whales. At one point, they had four orcas, killer whales, in their inventory. They're still the largest holder of captive marine mammals in the world. Right now, they've got 75 dolphins, 20 sea lions, two belugas. They, at one point during the Cold War, had over 140. And they said that the deployment of the dolphins here in southern Iraq was the first operational deployment of mine-detecting dolphins, which is technically true, although in Vietnam I've talked to Navy veterans who worked with them in planting limpet mines in Haiphong Harbor on wharfs and jetties there. They're also used for swimmer defense. They've just tested, shown off a couple of sea lions in Bahrain who are trained to attach cuffs to divers' legs, and then that's linked with a line that they get pulled out of the water. They also did dolphin deployments in 87, rather, in during the Iran-Iraq War in the Gulf. They call it the swimmer defense program, and the swimmer defense is also swimmer nullification. They've used them both in non-lethal and lethal ways, although the Navy denies its classified lethal activity. Swimmer nullifications ranged from killing divers during the Vietnam War using hypodermic needles attached to CO2 cartridges to more recent weaponization of both sea lions and dolphins with a 45 caliber small bang stick attached to their snouts.
You wrote an article in response to the Washington Post piece, David Helvarg, about the use of the K-Dog, the dolphin, in Umkasar.
Sort of a point of view. I'm trying to anthropomorphize a little and take the dolphin's point of view, which is like, hey, dude, it's not our war. I mean, you know, they call it an all-volunteer military, but I don't remember any of these dolphins who got gillnetted out of the Gulf of Mississippi volunteering. Now, of course, they have a breeding program within within their system, and right now a couple of the beluga whales are off at SeaWorld breeding, which is certainly a better deployment than chasing after mines in southern Iraq.
Let me ask William Rivas. Rivas, you were in the Navy before you became the campaign coordinator for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA.
I was. After high school, I joined the military and spent about 8 years in the military and was actually sent to the Persian Gulf twice. That's something that David mentioned about the military, that the U.S. military is an all-volunteer force. And should continue to be an all-volunteer force. And these animals did not volunteer for this war. War is a human endeavor. A person or a political party or a nation can, in fact, choose to go to war. The animals cannot. David mentioned the inventory that the military has. According to the Navy's own Marine Mammal Inventory report, over 96 dolphins have died in this program for a number of reasons, one of which that I thought was particularly interesting, and the cause of death was failure to adapt, drowning, jaw fractures. I mean, these animals have been suffering before they even reach the Persian Gulf.
Can you talk more about your letter to Rumsfeld?
Excuse me. Yes, we wrote to Donald Rumsfeld, you know, telling him exactly that this war is a human endeavor and that all these animals should be given an honorable discharge and be released and allowed to do natural things, allow them to live their own life and not to go into shark-infested, mine-infested waters in the Persian Gulf and search for mines.
Yeah, it's interesting. At the end of the Cold War, there's a lot of talk of closing the program down. And then the Navy got into littoral warfare, specifically shallow water warfare, as their post-Cold War strategy, in which they got very interested in using the dolphins in mine warfare and ordnance recovery. And so the program continues, even though they now have AUVs, autonomous underwater vehicles, that could do mine detection and other technical means for working. They talk about keeping the animals for the foreseeable future. Recently, when I was out visiting with the dolphins in San Diego when I was working on the book, they'd been testing them for a response to low-frequency sonar, and they did find a response, temporary hearing loss, from the use of the Navy's new low-frequency sonar system that's been linked to the deaths of beak whales and other animals in the wild. So it's kind of interesting. The Navy's always promoting its marine mammal as a partnership in the sea. At the same time, it's looking for exemptions under the Marine Mammal Protection Act so that it can kill more cetaceans, dolphins and whales, with the use of this active sonar system. This $350 million program, they say, is to pursue quieter diesel-powered submarines, although, in fact, there are other technical means that could be used, airborne remote sensing, to find those submarines. But, again, the Navy's, claiming that it's great partners with these weaponized animals and at the same time looking for exemptions from the one act that was passed specifically to protect marine mammals.
Would you say that this makes animals targets, David Helvarg?
Absolutely. I mean, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union built an entire counter-dolphin program that included anti-dolphin dolphins, dolphins trained to kill dolphins that came into, U.S. dolphins came into their waters. And clearly with the appearance of mine-hunting dolphins and swimmer defense dolphins, any shallow water environment where there's a hostile nation is going to start killing dolphins and sea lions if they see them, if they expect the U.S. to get involved in these areas. And this is the problem. We're putting the animals in harm's way. And I've covered four wars. I'm unfortunately thinking that we're going to continue having wars as long as we function as the way we do as a species. But, the use of marine mammals to fight our wars, the destruction of their prey sources and habitat in the world's oceans just doesn't reflect well on us as a species.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been speaking to William Rivas-Rivas of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and David Helvarg, author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. We're going to go out with Dana Lyons' song, Cows with Guns. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Bill Katsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Die to be it at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it. Nobody knew. No one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cows ate.